This is in the nature of kings and presidents, to lie when it's in their interest to do so.
Those men and women in uniform aren't legionnaires serving a Roman Caesar bent on empire. They are American citizens who have taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution.
So many families in the territories have had people go through jail in the last 3 years of conflict. I think the Red Cross estimates that at least 30,000 people have circled through Israeli jails since September 2000.
They're being treated as liars, they're being insulted at the hearings, and after that hearing, they don't have a second chance. That's it for them.
It's a catch-22. They hold you in jail as if you were a major criminal, but they don't even pay for a lawyer for you.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, August 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. An Iraqi general and one of Saddam Hussein's former bodyguards were among 14 Iraqis captured during a raid near Tikrit today. U.S. Army spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Steve Russell said the Iraqis were captured after a three-hour raid on 20 homes south of the city, which is Saddam Hussein's ancestral home. The detainees were described as members of a family closely associated with Saddam. According to the Army, about 200 U.S. soldiers participated in the raid. Flames shot 200 feet into the air from a burst oil pipeline north of Baghdad today, and U.S. forces fired warning shots to keep people from the scene. A U.S. soldier was killed when roadside bombs blasted an American convoy west of the capital. Two M1 Abrams tanks and three soldiers crouched in firing positions ordered a fire truck to stay back from the blaze. They were very hostile, said Fire Department Lieutenant Hassanein Mohammed. The blaze near Taji, a region of date groves, military compounds, and chemical plants, was burning about 3 miles north of a big refinery. It erupted in a grove of date palms less than 100 yards from a highway, sending a huge black cloud drifting south over the capital for several hours this afternoon. The commander of the U.S. forces announced today that all troops in Iraq should expect to serve for at least a year, with brief rest breaks in the region and possibly a few days at home. That came as news to some soldiers. It's a one-year rotation, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez told the Associated Press in an interview. Every soldier has been told that they will be deployed for a year, and then at the end of the year, we'll be working to send them home, he said. But some of the 148,000 soldiers in Iraq said nobody told them how long they would remain in the country, where guerrillas attack Americans daily and high temperatures often top 120 degrees. They need to come home, Kimberly, the wife of a reservist deployed in February, wrote on the website of the support organization Military Families Speak Out. Our unit has no redeployment date in sight, and we are constantly told that they may even be extended. Fleeing refugees reported vicious attacks today as Liberia's second rebel group began pressing toward the capital. Within Monrovia, Liberia's main rebel group signed a pledge to withdraw from the capital's port, allowing food and aid to flow. The sudden trouble on Liberia's second front came one day after President Charles Taylor resigned and went into exile in Nigeria. Even as Liberia's main rebel movement, Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, met West African and U.S. officials, the second rebel group sprang back into motion in what appeared a bid to get a share of the power or spoils in a post-Taylor Liberia. Responding to recent bombings in Israel today, Secretary of State Colin Powell spoke to the young people of Israel and Palestine to encourage them to be hopeful for the peace process, asserting that the process is not over, that the key to peace is for all parties to work together.
Young people and old people all together join hands and say, enough, enough. This must stop. We must stop denying ourselves the opportunity to grasp the future that we owe to these young people. I've already seen reports on television say, well, the roadmap is now finished, or ceasefire is over, or this is all off track. No, it is not. We cannot let it go off track. We will continue to move forward on the roadmap. We will continue to do everything we can, both as the United States of America, but also working with the quartet members that you've heard about, the Russian Federation, European Union and the United Nations, as well as working with leaders in the region, Arab leaders in the region, and with Prime Minister Sharon and Prime Minister Abbas and all others who are committed to peace, to come together and once again say, we will go forward. We will not be stopped by bombs. We will not be stopped by this kind of violence, because we owe it to you. We owe it to you to give you a better world, a better part of the world than we have seen in these recent years.
Secretary of State Colin Powell, two Palestinian suicide bombers have killed two Israelis in back-to-back attacks, shattering 6 weeks of relative calm during the ceasefire. A faction of Hamas claimed responsibility for the attacks, saying they were in retaliation for Israeli attacks in which two of its members were assassinated last week. PeaceWatch spoke with Nicole Gawet, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem today, and asked her if she thought this obvious violation of the ceasefire represented a rejection of the peace process by either or both parties.
No, I don't think it does. And you have to keep in mind that the relative calm has been very relative. There has been one attack in July, a very odd one, by Palestinian militants on a private home near Tel Aviv. That was July 7th. But on the Israeli side, over the last 40 days of this ceasefire, there have been a number of raids into Palestinian areas and at least 15 Palestinians killed, including the two Hamas members killed in the raid on Friday. So the Hamas bombing in the West Bank settlement was not a surprise. In fact, on Friday, after the Israelis killed the two Hamas members, Hamas announced that they would answer but would still hold the ceasefire. They've since said that they feel that they can make minor violations of the ceasefire since Israel has, ever since the ceasefire was announced, June 29th. The other bombing in Rosh Ha'ayin, which is in Israel proper, was carried out by the Alak, the Martyrs Brigade, their militant offshoot of Yasser Arafat's Fatah faction. And they have never really agreed to the ceasefire. They also claimed that their bombing was in response to the Israeli raid on Friday.
It sounds like there's a whole new definition of the word ceasefire operating here. You said earlier relative calm, meaning very relative. Is it just a ceasefire in word only, not in actual practice? Or politically, how is this being cast?
Yeah, it's a very odd thing because really, it's sort of unilateral. Israel has reserved the right to conduct raids and to defend itself. It says to defuse what it calls ticking bombs, people who are maybe on their way to conduct some sort of bombing.
Kind of like a preemptive strike.
Exactly. It's never been a party to this ceasefire. In fact, the only people who've formally agreed to it are Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Fatah faction. And it is purely sort of a compromise, really, for the Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, who isn't weak enough to disarm these groups, but needs a period of calm.
You mean who isn't strong enough to disarm these groups?
Sorry, pardon me. Mm-hmm. He isn't strong enough to disarm these groups yet.
So it's just some sort of diplomatic language.
It does. And for a group like Hamas, which has made huge gains in popularity over the 3 years of the Intifada, it also serves a purpose because it allows them to convert this newfound popularity into, I think, what they hope will be a larger, legitimate, formalized political base.
Mm-hmm. Now, Israel postponed releasing some 76 Palestinian prisoners in response to these latest attacks. And the Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, said the Palestinians had no hope of winning statehood if Palestinian authorities cannot stop the so-called militant groups. There seems to be a sort of one-upsmanship going on between the two sides. Is that your assessment of the situation, or would you characterize it differently?
Well, to me it looks a little like a catch-22. The Israelis will not move forward on the roadmap peace plan to give Palestinians a state until they crack down on the militants, and yet the Palestinian Authority is too weak to do so right now. So they're stalemated, and in the midst of this stalemate, Israeli raids continue. So it doesn't seem to me that the ceasefire can last, or if it does, it will be punctuated by events like today's.
Is there a role for the international community to play? Of course, we know that President Bush has, and the Bush administration has put forth this roadmap for peace. But is there, a stop along the way for the Bush administration to nudge this process along, in your opinion?
Well, the Bush administration has set up a team here to monitor progress on the roadmap, and its leader has recently acknowledged publicly that he thinks the Palestinians aren't strong enough to confront militant groups yet. And he has, I think, recommended steps to strengthen the Palestinian Authority so it can do so. And I think that would be a huge step forward, that the Americans, the Europeans, the UN could do to stabilize the situation. And the prisoner release is part of that because it boosts the prime minister enormously in Palestinian eyes, since so many families in the territories have had people go through jail in the last 3 years of conflict. I think the Red Cross estimates that at least 30,000 people have circled through Israeli jails since September 2000.
30,000 Palestinians?
Yes, in and out of Israeli jails over the course of the Intifada.
What role is there for Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas to actually pursue at this point? You said he's too weak to really prevent the militants from launching these attacks. Of course, he ended a tour of the Gulf states to return because of the bombings, and he condemned the attacks, but also condemned Israel for army raids into the Palestinian cities in search of the wanted militants. What might he do, in your opinion, at this point, at this stage of the game?
I think he will probably turn to the U.S. and appeal for their help, maybe in getting Israel to scale back a bit on its raids into Palestinian territories. He's probably going to go back to the militant groups and appeal for calm, and do what he can to consolidate the base he has. It's small. He has no natural constituency among the Palestinians, but it is growing because they've appreciated the recognition he's gotten from the states and the small improvements ordinary Palestinians have seen in their lives since June 4th when the roadmap was formally accepted.
Mm. And then there's the recent Israeli military attacks on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. What effect, if any, do these have on the peace process, such as it is?
Well, not much on the peace process. If that situation escalates, it's going to strain Israel a little bit because they will be dealing with two fronts. The attack that was Sunday that left a 16-year-old boy dead was treated here as a bolt out of the blue, but, you know, outside of Israel, I think it's widely seen as a response to a car bombing that killed a Hezbollah leader that was attributed to Israel. I believe that was in August.
Last week, Israel's security minister said Jews would be able to resume visits to a Jerusalem shrine holy to both Jews and Muslims, where until now only Muslims had been praying there. This action would end a ban on non-Muslim visitors to the shrine that has been maintained since the uprising began. In response, Hamas has threatened more violence. What do you think the reasons might be for making this move at this time?
It's interesting. I'm not entirely sure because it's inflammatory. I mean, given the shrine's history in this particular phase of the conflict, you may remember that on September 28th, 2000, Ariel Sharon, who was then the leader of the opposition, went up with hundreds and hundreds of policemen and soldiers to pay a visit. At the time, the Prime Minister Barak was in negotiations with Arafat and was discussing giving the shrine to Palestinian control. Sharon made his visit to make the point that that he believes is Jewish property and should never be relinquished. That, of course, sparked immense demonstrations that the Israelis responded to with live fire, killing Palestinians and launching us into the conflict now. It's an odd thing to do given that the Palestinians are trying very hard to have a ceasefire.
Nicole Galwet, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking with us today from Jerusalem. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. One American soldier was killed and two were wounded by roadside bombs in the Iraqi town of Ramadi, west of Baghdad today. The attack occurred as an American military convoy passed nearby. Several hundred miles to the south, British troops say things are calmer in Basra since two people were killed during weekend riots over fuel and electricity shortages. Iraq's governing council announced plans today to reopen the Basra airport, possibly as soon as the end of the month. The council said it's asked six Middle Eastern and European airlines to prepare for a resumption of flights to and from the airport. International flights to Iraq were suspended after the 1991 Gulf War. While the social and political situation may appear to be stabilizing in some parts of Iraq, most of the country is still without adequate electricity, sanitation or sewage systems, and street crime is still a daily occurrence. Speaking this afternoon on CNN, former Iraqi ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Duri, offered harsh criticism of the failure of U.S. forces to bring order to the country, as well as to grant Iraqis political self-determination.
Where is the democracy? Where is the freedom? Where is food? Where is medicine? Where is work? 75% of Iraq, of Iraqi people without work. There is a kind of famine in Iraq. There is no food for Iraqi people. There is no medicine. Where is the medicine? Where is the liberty? Where is the freedom?
Former Iraqi ambassador to the UN, Mohammed al-Duri. Well, one person who predicted the instability that's now engulfing Iraq is former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. Speaking last week on Peace Watch, he compared the situation to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, stating that he always thought the U.S. would win all its military endeavors, but it would still lose the war in the end, overburdened by the ensuing chaos. In a conversation earlier this week with Ambrose Lane on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, Ritter said that speaking out against the war and occupation of Iraq is, in fact, the most patriotic action an American can take.
The foundation of what we stand for is that document, the Constitution of the United States of America, the concept of a nation of the people. It begins, we the people of the United States. We are the government. We are responsible for what transpires in our nation. And I'm also somebody who not only has read the Constitution, but taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I believe in a citizen's not only role, but obligation to ensure that those whom we elect to higher office abide by the Constitution. Because if the Constitution becomes nothing more than just a symbol, words, then we have ceased to exist as the United States of America. And that's something that I don't want to stand by idly and let happen.
And I loved your early quote of Theodore Roosevelt, who wrote, to announce that there must be no criticism of the president or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public. And then you talk about the two faces of patriotism. Tell our listeners what you mean by the two faces of patriotism.
I think it's important to note that he spoke that during World War I about Woodrow Wilson. So it's not just a term that he threw out there in times of peace. He spoke about it during wartime in criticism of a sitting president who was getting our nation involved in a war that Theodore Roosevelt disagreed with. So I raise that quote because today we're faced with a situation where American citizens who have honest disagreements with the direction our government has taken in regards to war in Iraq are being called unpatriotic, being called treasonous. And when Americans turn on the television or are exposed to the media today, patriotism seems to be defined by those who wave the American flag and shout, support our troops. And when we look at television, we see these troops, these soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marine who serve our country so proudly, and we tend to say that is the definition of a true patriot, somebody who has put on the uniform and has gone overseas to defend our country, to make the ultimate sacrifice in defense of our country. But what they fail to realize is that those men and women in uniform aren't legionnaires serving a Roman Caesar bent on empire. They are American citizens who have taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. Now, understand, when you wear the uniform, you are not free to question the legality of any action, constitutionally speaking. Yes, you don't obey an illegal order if you're ordered to torture somebody or murder somebody. You have to disobey that. But when you're ordered to launch a frontal attack on Iraq, you don't sit back and say, well, wait a minute, has this gone through all the checks and balances? Has Congress weighed in effectively? Is this constitutional? No, you obey the order because you are an American serviceman, an American servicewoman who is comfortable with the concept that they would not be ordered to do this if the American people felt this was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the other face of patriotism is that American citizen who stands out on the street in protest, who writes letters to their congressman, who says, wait a minute, we don't believe that this war is just, that this war is correct. To say that those Americans who demonstrated against this war are any less patriotic than those Americans who fought in this war shows a gross misunderstanding of what it means to be an American.
People need to know that what we call today the big lie, you said, was the truth when it was first enunciated back in 1991. Connected.
When the Bush administration stands up in 2002, citing data from 1991, 1992, saying because it existed then, it exists now, that is false. That is a fundamental lie that they are telling. They need to provide new evidence, and there is no new evidence. They couldn't provide anything new. So it's the big lie that's being told today. Had they said these same words in 1991, it would have been the truth.
In fact, it became a political problem for Daddy Bush, and he lost in November of 92. But before leaving office, specifically on January 15th and 16th of 93, he ordered a series of attacks on Iraq, using the no-fly zone violations as the reason. And then on January 17th, 93, he ordered a massive cruise missile attack on factories in southern Iraq. Talk about those facts. What was going on there?
On the surface, what you have is the Iraqi government saying that they were obstructing the work of the inspectors because the inspectors had left Iraq. Most of the inspectors have left Iraq in December 1992 for Christmas break. The United States had imposed a no-fly zone on southern Iraq in the fall of 1992 that did not have any legitimacy in terms of international law.
There was no legal basis for it, was it?
Pardon?
There was no legal basis for establishing
no-fly zones. No, none whatsoever. And when you think of international law, you know, sovereign airspace, just imagine if Cuba started, you know, saying, well, we're going to create a no-fly zone in Florida.
Right.
And we're going to put Cuban combat aircraft over Florida and bomb anything we want to, anytime we want to. And then they pretended that it was supported by the United Nations. The United Nations never provided a resolution. There was never any voicing of support for this. It's a unilateral action. We would want to shoot down every Cuban airplane that came over our airspace.
Absolutely.
But there was another agenda going on here.
Mm-hmm.
By forcefully attacking Iraq, they established a precedent of military action against Iraq designed to further contain Iraq because Papa Bush was out.
Yes.
Bill Clinton was in, and Bill Clinton had indicated that he might want to relook the Iraq situation.
Mm-hmm.
He might want to, you know, he's someone who said, I'm a good Southern Baptist. I believe in deathbed conversions. And he said, you know, maybe Saddam can convert. And that's, of course, the last thing the Republicans wanted. And so they were basically, you know, stacking the deck against Bill Clinton's potential
right before Bush
for
left
a peaceful
office.
Resolution.
Mm-hmm. What, tell our listeners the relationship between what Daddy Bush enunciated as his New World Order and the 1992 Defense Policy Guidance document, and tell, share with them who were involved in the preparation of that document.
Well, President George Herbert Walker Bush is somebody who, whether you like him or not, I think you need to respect the fact that this is a man who had a tremendous amount of experience in international affairs and understood the role of the United States and the complexity of the situation out there. He was ambassador to the United Nations, director of the CIA, ambassador to China. So this is a man who had, you know, had a sound grasp of what was going on. Whether or not his policies were correct is a different situation.
Right.
I believe that he recognized that in order in the post-Soviet era, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the best way to move forward from the American perspective was as part of an international community, using the United Nations as a vehicle that would help prevent the recurrence of a Soviet Union and also bring stability to the world. So he spoke of a new world order that centered on the United Nations. This was a departure from neoconservative thinking from the times of the Reagan administration, people who said, we are at war with the Soviet Union. It's a Cold War, but a war nonetheless, and we will destroy the Soviet Union and then replace the Soviet Union with American empire, American hegemony. And one of the architects of this thinking was a gentleman named Dick Cheney, who at that time was the Secretary of Defense. And he had surrounding him a number of like-minded neoconservative thinkers. Paul Wolfowitz was working for him. Scooter Libby was working for him. Of course, Wolfowitz today is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Libby is Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff. But they drafted a different vision of the world, one which said we will break from the United Nations, that we will step into the vacuum created by the collapse of the Soviet Union and impose a unilateralist American hegemony on the globe, American empire. And it spoke of unilateral military action, spoke of dominating the globe military and economically. And fortunately, when it was leaked to the press in 1992, most people, including the President of the United States, recognized it as a fundamentally un-American policy and shot it down. And they didn't have time to redraft it because Bill Clinton won the election in November 1992, and these neoconservatives were booted out of the White House. Thankfully so. Tragically, they're back in, and they have reimposed their vision
of global hegemony. Tell our listeners what the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, is all about, and how how its statement of foreign policy principles might be related to that 1992 defense policy document.
Well, it's not that they're related. It's the exact same thing. Project for a New American Century is a think tank type organization that was brought together because they were fearful of what they called, you know, Bill Clinton's, you know, damaging foreign policies. They said America's heading in the wrong direction, and they felt a need to come together and articulate a vision for America, a role for America, and the centerpiece of this vision was this 1992 defense reorganization paper drafted under Dick Cheney's instructions. Happened to be close in line, and I'll preface this by saying that, you know, you'll find no stronger friend of Israel than me. I respect Israel's right to exist, and I am somebody who believes that the United States, having voted in favor of the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, we have a responsibility to guarantee Israel's defense. This doesn't mean, however, we turn a blind eye to policies carried out by Israel that are bad for America and bad for Israel.
Right.
I believe that the Project for a New American Century is dominated by people who have used the Israeli crisis for their own political benefit here at home. And they have brought into their mix organizations like AIPAC, which is the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. It's a political group that puts pressure on Congress and has a history of actually singling out congressmen and senators who don't agree with a strong pro-Israeli policy to defeat them at the polls. And this is the kind of intimidation that the Project for New American Century has taken. And they basically now have thrown out an articulated vision, denied the United States of America as a whole the ability to determine whether or not that's the vision they want. They've bullied and intimidated people to get aspects of this vision put into American policy, such as a continuation of the lethal finding to eliminate Saddam Hussein, etc. And then, after the 2000 elections, they have hijacked the American national security decision-making hierarchy. We have a group of people today in power, absolute power, that we, the people, didn't vote for.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't vote for the Project for New American Century to mm-hmm. take over the United States. We didn't vote for this neoconservative hijacking. We didn't vote for all the baggage they brought with them. These are political appointees who avoided congressional oversight hearings. These are people who snuck into their positions, and now they have shielded themselves, especially in the aftermath of September 11th, with a wall of secrecy that prevents the kind of probing oversight necessary to ensure that we are a democratic republic, not an oligarchy.
Especially given our having gone to war.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I feel so strongly about this war, not because I'm, you know, a closet fan of Saddam Hussein, but because I'm an American patriot who loves my country. It's not as though the Bush administration came forward in 2002 and said, we're going to war to remove Saddam Hussein because he's a bad guy. We're going to war for the Iraqi people. We're going to war to get rid of a murderer. We're going to war, you know, for human rights. That's not what they said. They said, we're going to war because of the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. We're supposed to be this nation that stands for these wonderful ideals and values, et cetera, and we're governed by an administration that can't tell the truth about anything. I'm not an expert in the economy and et cetera like that, so I don't want to head down that path. But my feeling is if you're a liar on something as fundamental as war, where you're putting American lives at risk, you're a liar at just about everything else.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter speaking with Ambrose Lane on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington.
Hi, this is Scott Gurian, the producer of Peace Watch. If you're enjoying listening to this show, I urge you to take a moment and make a donation to ensure that this program continues. You can make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at www.pacifica.org or send us a tax-deductible check or money order to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, 20009, and note that it's a donation for Peace Watch. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.